Good evening to all. Pranam, welcome to those who just arrived, to those who arrived yesterday, to those who are here and keep arriving, and we keep arriving and we keep arriving. This ever deepening converging point that keeps getting bigger and bigger. So once I remember talking to Father Richard, he told me, like, we're naturally, God's heart keeps getting bigger and bigger. Like, just like if you will say, like, oh, it's sunny today, no, it's just some casual observation, like, oh, God's heart keeps getting bigger and bigger. So I was like, stop there, Richard, please. I need to fathom the implications of that. What to do with that casual line you just threw out of the blue? We know who is the blue, so out of the blue, with capital B. Yes, God's heart keeps getting bigger and bigger. The arrival keeps getting bigger and bigger, deeper and deeper. So, because that's where we are, our journey is pointing to, right? To the heart of reality. So here we are trying to excavate together, and today we have another session for quest and exploration, as we like to call it, Q&E, where we are invited to bring our exploration, excavation tools, and know that those are only part of the process, and big part of the excavation is done beyond whatever toolkit we may bring to the table, and grace doing a big part of the job, but still we have to do our part. When they give this example of someone falling into a ditch, no, into a hole, no? And you have fallen like 10 meters below, and there's no way for you to get out, but there are some things for you to do that nobody else can do them for you, which is to ask, to scream for help. Yeah, the person outside cannot do that for you because they don't know even. And then someone comes, sees your situation, and throws a rope. And again, only you can take the rope. So it's not much in comparison to what the other person is doing, coming, running, bringing the rope, making the bigger force, so to say, to take you out. You are just like being carried out.
But
But you have to carry the rope, take the rope. And of course, when you are saved and taken out of that dark hole, so to say, you will never say the person, did you see how nicely I caught hold on the rope? No? You will say, thank you saved my life. Right. Still, you had to do some things yourself. But the main part in the equation, it's coming from the other side, so to say. So similarly, we bring our toolkit for exploration, we bring our will, but trusting that on the other side, so to say, not to make it too other. The other side is on our side. There's coming so much willingness to help and to rescue and to enlighten and to heal, but we have to do our part. So showing up courageously, openly, and trying to allow grace to do its part as well. So once came this idea that our business is to trust that Krishna is doing his business. The Krishna is already doing his business as protector, benefactor, lover, blesser. He's already doing his business. He never failed one day to his job. And our business is just to trust that that's true. And sometimes that business seems insurmountably impossible. So, but that's our business. His business, he's doing his business. We have to do ours. Then we can become good business partners. There will be some interesting, juicy project together. So anyhow, all that to say, All inquiries are welcome. All themes, explorations, whatever you would like to bring to our attention today. Our attention, our tension, whatever needs to be invoked that is necessary to share. And raise your non-digital hand. You were waiting for a moment. You're raising your hand like a digital
Yeah, I don't know.
assassin.
Yeah, that was deliberate. That was deliberate.
So Jamuna started, and I saw someone else in the back. I saw no, not yet. Yeah. We're okay with light like that? It's fine. Okay, I'm fine, but just in case. Okay.
So your introduction, Candlelight, very much is in with what I wanted to ask. I believe I heard somewhere something in this regard. So we have the eternally liberated souls. They're there, they're made of love, they're eternally immersed in loving Krishna. They know nothing else but him. Then we have us, Tathasta, marginalized beings, and in
Marginal.
marginal,
That's not the
marginalized,
same.
marginal. Okay. And we have a choice. And in our quest to develop a relationship, to a loving relationship, to fall in love with God, you know, it's a very, very wiggly path. It's snakes and ladders all the way until it's not. And so this is me coming from my human perspective. If somebody loved me because they just loved me, that they had no other option, so to speak, they're made of, I just want to love Jamuna. That's all I can do. And then there was somebody, and I have that love. There's a loving relationship there. That's just it's just going on. And then I have somebody who's really struggling. We're in a dynamic together, and I'm wanting to help them, and they're struggling, and I'm reaching out, and they're reaching, and they're slipping, and we're still, and then we fall in love. You know, they fall in love with me. That relationship would be, it would have a certain flavor to it because of that struggle that the person had had. So this is me coming from my human perspective. So I'm wondering, is it like, does Krishna have the relationship that he has, the love that he has for souls that come, for us jivas that go back? Go back, go in, go around. Are we, is it of another flavor, another dimension?
In comparison to the eternally
Yeah.
liberated souls.
So choice from somebody who has, I'm not saying that they don't have a choice, but they're, you know, they're made of love. That's, and those of us that.
Of course, this brief answer will be yes. There is a different flavor, but also it will be yes in the sense that there is a different flavor to any single relationship God has with every single person. Just to remember
And
that.
that's always growing and
And that's always growing and deepening. So it's not like, okay, here are the eternally liberated souls, one flavor. Conditioned souls going through a struggle, choosing to love him, flavor two. Those are the options in the menu. So to say, no. It's each one of us. That's also flavor. So each one of us potentially can provide that flavor in relationship with God. So it's very uniquely, very specified. But something in connection to your question is mentioned by Sanatana Goswami in the Briha Bhagavatamrita, where he says something to the effect that the sadhana siddhas Sadhana siddhi is someone who attains siddhi or perfection through practice, through sadhana, and through all the dynamics that sadhana entails, versus the nitya siddhas, the eternally perfected, liberated souls. He says that somehow he kind of expresses some special value in the fact that these people have gone through all that and achieved Bhagavan. Of course, he's not making a claim to say they are better, because that's when where our mind quickly runs to. So who is better, right? Because you can make cases for both being better, and that makes the point that there's no need to make either of those cases, right? Like, you can say, okay, the eternal liberated souls are better because they're made of love. And they have chosen to love God in deeper and deeper ways from time without beginning. They are better. We have been given the choice to choose to love God from time without beginning, and we have not done so. Therefore, we are not better. So that's one way you can become humbled, not traumatized. But also, you can make the other case, which is, well, but these eternally liberated souls, they never chose, they didn't have any other choice in the sense that they already were there. And again, it is what it is. There's no question here, but why? It's like asking why Krishna is Krishna, right? But why Radha? Basically, to ask why Yashoda, why Nanda, is basically the same. Because Krishna is inseparable from the love that makes him who he is. So, as much as you argue why the eternal associates in Vrindavan, you're arguing why Krishna in Vrindavan. Right? So, there's no why to go there. But again, one could make this case, okay, the eternal associate never had a choice, but these people had a choice and they chose various things, but eventually they made the right choice in the right direction. And that has an extra value. Again, each one of them have its own charm. So we are not here to establish one is better, one is, but definitely both have their own flavor. In general, okay, so those who are loving God from time without beginning, made of love, and in an ever-deepening experience of that love, that has a unique flavor, and it's beautiful. It's incredible, and we are actually invited to follow in their footsteps. Now that's Raga Anuga Bhakti. So watch out for downplaying them or saying they are worse than anything. They are worse when I'm trying to follow your footsteps. It's like, right? But at the same time, yeah, of course, in Krishna's eyes, as you was your question, to see those who are sadhakas going through all that and eventually arriving. Reaching him, that's a unique, has a unique flavor, which may not be present in the other people, and that people have a new flavor, they may not be present in the other person. And as I say, at the end, every single individual has a unique flavor that is not present in anyone else. Because at the end of the day, each one of us will be offering our hearts in a very uniquely personalized, tasteful way, which is irrepeatable for any other's heart. And Krishna will reciprocate in kind to that in a uniquely personalized form. We will be talking about that in a few days in one verse that we'll be studying. One from many verses in the Shastra says that Krishna takes different forms to reciprocate to the love of his devotees. That he adopts particular shapes to respond to the shape of love, the shape of the heart of each devotee, right? So, but yeah, that will be my answer. I don't know if that helps. It's not, again, worse, better. It's, and of course, from our particular perspective, again, we are to, on one side, to appreciate the role of the eternal associates, the embodiments of love, the role models to follow, the eternal paradigmatic figures in the Leela. That embody a type of love that we aspire for, aspirationally speaking. They are these emblems of aspiration for us. And from our particular side, we have a lot of encouragement knowing how Krishna, the sweet absolute responds to, oops, I want to share something, but I'm going to get, give me a moment. And also for us as sadhakas, there's a lot of hope in knowing how Krishna is feeling for those of us who are going through all these struggles and so on. And what I want to share that I share a few times is the beautiful verses in which Krishna, how Krishna is reply, as I said the other day, I referred to that Krishna is welcoming Gopa Kumar here right to Vrindavan. Again, Gopa Kumar is not a Nitya Siddha. So he's gone through all this, and Krishna is feeling like, and he's experiencing this unique joy of the new arrival, which again, that experience is not there for the with the Nitya. And he's telling them, and again, I'll read a few verses, beautiful verses, and that's how he feels, not only for Gopa Kumar, again, uniquely in its own way for Gopa Kumar, but uniquely in its own way for each one of us, even before we have arrived, so to say, to that level of arrival. Like Krishna's grateful before an offering is made. Okay. So Krishna's saying to telling Gopa Kumar, welcome, welcome, my dear child. I am fortunate, most fortunate, to meet you here. For so long, I have been longing to see you. My dear friend and darling, you have passed through many lifetimes without so much as a glance in my direction. Yet I was always there, a fool dancing with hope, thinking perhaps in this lifetime or this one or this, he will finally turn to me. Yet I could find no excuse to bring you to my abode, my brother, while still upholding the eternal laws I myself have created. You never called my name, not even once in passing. Had you done so, I could have bent the rules and brought you to me. But without your slightest intention, how could I? That would not have been love. It would have been a flawed wrongdoing. Realizing, well, it continues. There are many verses, right? Anyway. And then at the end, he says to Gopa Kumar, today, Krishna speaking to Gopa Kumar, not the other way around. No, don't forget who is talking to whom. Bhagavan says, today you have fulfilled the longing I have held in my heart for so long. Please, by you coming here, basically. That's, please nourish your happiness and mine by staying here forever. So yeah, that's a very unique type of appreciation and feeling that Sweet Absolute will have for those who are not the eternal associates, in one sense. Which again doesn't make us better than anyone. In that realm, nobody's, though we hear speak about Nitya Siddhas, Sadhana Siddhas, eternal associates, those who are all there, nobody has awareness of who is the Nitya Siddha and who is not the Nitya Siddha. It's not like, hey, like here, how dare to talk to me? I'm in group. I have been there from time without beginning. Like here, they will say, "Hey, I've been initiated for 25 years. I'm a senior devotee." They can say, "I've been here for time without beginning." You are a newcomer. How dare you? So nobody's feeling that. Nobody's aware of, oh, this is Nitya Siddha. Everyone is Siddha. That's why once someone asked Srila Prabhupada about this, which is not your question, but somehow a related topic, like who is better, the Nitya Siddha or the Sadhana Siddha? And Prabhupada said the important word there is Siddha, which means perfect, perfect being. Nitya sadhana, when you reach siddhi or perfection, that's it. Nobody's like, again, calculating, counting, putting people in boxes. They need to see the box, the sadhana, see the box. So, But yeah, again, from our side, the sadhakas, I think statements like the ones we read give lots of hope and reassurance that, and it's not, again, it's not just, okay, once I reach there, I'll be acknowledged, but there is already a longing from the side of Bhagavan for us, even while we are not longing at all. And that's why Śrīla Siddhārtha wrote his book, Loving Search for the Lost Servant. First, he published the book In Search of Sri Krishna, Reality the Beautiful, which kind of emphasizes our search for Krishna. But then he felt we need to balance the equation, because it's not just us searching for Krishna. If we are searching for Krishna, it's because he was searching for us to begin with. So the next book was The Loving Search for the Lost Servant. So how the Sweet Absolute is longing for us. Yes. Yeah. And Srila Siddha Maharaj, just as a footnote, because he received inspiration for that title. I was listening to a lecture he gave recently again. And he quotes one verse from the Bhagavatam. There are two verses in the 11th canto that depict, according to some readers, they speak about Ramachandra, but there's a way of understanding those verses speaking about Mahaprabhu. And one line of the second verse say, Mayam Mrigam Dayita Ipsitu Ambadavat, which according to Ramachandra, that translation can mean Ramachandra went after the deer in the forest. And we know the Leela where there's a golden deer and Ramachandra goes after it, and then Sita is kidnapped, and the deer was this person. Took the form, Marichi, I think, took the form of the deer ordained by Ravana and so on. So that can be one line, but also if your Sanskrit lends itself to many readings, so Mayam Mrigam Dayita Ipsitu Ambadavat also means he ran after those people, he ran after his beloved. In this case, he ran after their beloved who were covered by Maya. Deluded by Maya. So the implication is for Mahaprabhu running after every soul in this world, covered by ignorance, and with mercy and compassion and glance and trying to give them. So Śrīla Siddhārtha, he said, after reading that line, came for me the inspiration for this book, The Loving Search for the Lost Servant, Mayam Mrigam Dayita Ipsitu Ambadavat. Like Krishna running, no? Running. Like I quoted that, no, the Śrīla Siddhārtha, since we are talking about him and that particular book, that's how I begin. I'm quoting from the fourth book that is to come. So chapter one begins with one line from Śrīla Siddhārtha Maharaj from this book, and he says, in connection to the title, The Loving Search for the Lost Servant. The Lord's search for his lost servants is a loving search. It is not ordinary, but from the heart. And the Lord's heart is not an ordinary heart. Who can estimate that what type of search he's engaged in? It is a mad search, an urgent campaign. Although he's full in all respects, still he feels pangs of separation from every one of us, however small we may be. Despite his supreme position, he has room for us in a corner of his loving heart. This is the nature of the infinite.
Peter.
So, again, all this in connection to how God feels for the non-nitya-siddhas. So that should be enough for us, so to say. I'm not like, why I'm not a nitya-siddha? Why these, many of these why questions are really, there are some other question behind the why question many times, and we need to get there. Yeah. Hope that helps.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. Some. I was going to say someone else racist, some racism.
I wanted to ask that it came to me earlier. I'm on the wall, but anyway. The question is, I know that in Srimad Bhagavatam, there's what Bhaktivinoda describes as like poetic descriptions of deeds and their punishments, you know, like a, of what hellish torment, basically. You know, like if you do this, then this will happen. If we do this, so I was wondering if does Yamaraj still hold his position? You know, if hell is more, if it's more of like a poetic deterrent, does Yamaraj still hold his role in the cosmic drama, so to speak?
We talked today something about Yamaraj. His name came today earlier or yesterday in
I
our
did
in a
bring it up. You
conversation,
said
right?
to ask it later.
And there's that glass there just in case for you to be aware of it. And also all these days after lecture, I found many glasses below the sofa. So since you drink, they put it there and then you forget. It's fine, but it's fine to remember also. So, well, regarding the question on if we consider the depiction of the hellish planets in the Bhagavatam as some type of poetic allegory, then what happens with Yamaraj? Does his post hold? And of course, first of all, being fair with the topic is that not everyone thinks that those depictions of the underworld, I will say, because sometimes hellish brings some, I don't know, some cultural connotations that are not so accurate or whatever they may trigger. You can call them the underworld or whatever other word. So some will totally agree that that's a reality, and on top of that, someone will agree that the descriptions that are found in the Bhagavatam are to be taken literally. That they are absolutely how to say proportional and corresponding in what they describe. Some others will say, "I think that's disproportionate." Well, I do not deny altogether the presence of those realms, and some others will say, "I don't believe in those realms." And I know different Gaudiya Vaishnavas in all these camps. Maybe you're wondering where do I stand? So I do not, and I've written a little bit about that, so a little bit you know about that, and this will come also in my next book. I don't consider that some of most of the depictions given in that section, fifth canto especially, but there are other parts also, I think third canto, many of them are clearly disproportionate. No, like if you fail in welcoming a Brahmin, you will be burned for eons. And that's like, whoa, really? Now, and on another side, you hear all the things that we just say, no? The loving search for the lost servant and this and that, and he's running. But all of that applies if you properly welcome a Brahmin at your house or whatever. That's not the only example. There are many. So it's totally free and loving and unconditional, with the exception of the 3,000 conditions. So how to process that? So yeah, my personal conviction, which is not only mine, is that that's kind of a particular literary device to exaggeration, basically, which is a literary device in different scriptures. It's not just something new. To invoke, I mean, creates a sense of fear, clearly. And it's directed to certain people who may only speak that language. Let's be honest. people speak very different languages. Someone sent me a quote today. I don't know, maybe some of you here don't remember. I don't even remember who said the quote, but it was, oh, no. I know who sent me the quote. Would say something like, yeah, like try the people are at different stages in their journey of evolution, on very different stages, to be honest, many cases. And sometimes you may try to explain something to them, certain level of truth, and it's absolutely impossible for them to grasp that. As you may try to approach a 2-year-old boy and try to explain to him algebra or something like that. It's not possible. It will be possible, but not now. So in the same way, there are some people who are really fear-oriented, and there are some sections in scripture addressing them to prevent them from wrongdoing through a language of fear, which unfortunately is the only language they understand. And we are not here saying that's the best, but also it's a way in which devotion extends itself. But I wouldn't necessarily cancel altogether the existence of those planetary systems, but I wouldn't depict them as scary, gruesome, monsterish, hellish, that you're like, everyone is re like, it seems almost like it is being relished that you are being chastised and tormented. Because again, we have to bring again over and over into the picture the God of unconditional love, which again doesn't cancel altogether karma and reaction, but not from a place of disproportionate torture. That many sections, if you go through them in detail, can feel like that. So in that case, I will personally conceive these sections, these realms as, let's call it centers for karmic healing. Not so much like you will go there to suffer endlessly, right? Because again, gives this idea of the vengeful God and karma merely as a cold law, rather than a restorative law, not punitive justice, but restorative justice, which is a huge topic even in this world. Like, you did something, you need to be chastised. But the idea is you need to be reformed through whatever is required, but the intentionality has to be healed, be reformed, just chastise. Tortured. It's like, so in that case, Yamaraj's post will remain, no? Because he, as an administrator of the karmic healing center, the post will remain basically, right? Now, if, to those who do not believe at all in those realms, then they have to give you. They have to give you, not me, their answer of what to do with Jamarash. My case, I don't necessarily feel we need to erase those realms, but yes, trying to define them according to God's unconditional love, which doesn't cancel karma, but which puts karma clearly in the context of restorative justice with an intention for redemption and healing. And not disproportionate torture, no? Which is not the same at all. Because if we do not think much about that, we may unconsciously be incorporating these two very contradictory ideas of God. On one hand, you have this sweet, intimate, loving, unconditionally longing for everyone, and then this other thing. And if we don't think about it, the two get ingrained and created some their own like concocted distortion and very strange combination. And there are many ways to make to create very unpalatable forms of rasa abhas from sort of very distorted combinations of flavors. And I've seen many times devotees saying things, entering into those things like, oh yeah, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Karuna Sindhu. No, they pray in the morning before the class. Krishna, ocean of mercy. And then like, oh, I failed to chant my 16th round today. Oh, probably you'll be born as a frog next life. I mean, literally hurt, so not exaggerated. So here you have the ocean of mercy, and we talked today, these days, about Krishna feeling grateful for the offerings you haven't even made in advance and all this. But again, comes all this. But if you are not perfect in your performance of the daily quota, everything starts to risk. It's like two do not hold at the same time. So if two together are contradictory. So it's important that whenever how we process the information we receive from scripture, the things we hear, that we can process everything in a coherent way. And for that to happen, we may need lots of struggles and questions and integration, and it's not easy, but it's important that we keep a coherent picture of the divine that is mostly primarily aligned with the principle of love, which is the main attribute of the divine, rather than anything else. So, yeah, love prevails. Love rules. Yeah. So we say in our tradition, all rules are to serve love, which means love rules. Right. So everything else is secondary. If all rules exist in the service of love, that means love rules. So whatever any other thing or concept or idea we receive, that has to be accommodated or understood in the context of love. If not, if we give priority to something else and love becomes secondary, tertiary, we're in trouble. We no longer have an unloving God, and we start to have who knows what, judgmental, authoritarian, easy, angry father, cosmic figure, or I don't know, eternal hell here, disproportionate torture over there, and you name it. Endless varieties of human misreading of the sweet absolute, which is no longer sweet at that time. So you have this bitter absolute, bittersweet absolute. Sweet absence. Yeah. No, that helps.
Yeah, totally. I remember two examples of people standing on podiums and just with the megaphones, just telling everyone, "You're going to hell if you don't. You'll be burned and whipped." Things like that.
Yeah. And then quoting the Bible also saying God is love.
Yeah.
It's like, again, sometimes you can find apparently contradictory statements in scripture, like the ones I just mentioned regarding hellish planets, if you read them literally. So then you need to engage in what we call some samanya, or like reconciliation. Rupa Goswami says in Lagu Bhagavatamrita, you cannot just cherry pick. And today I was walking and by the path that were the cherries, and I was thinking, oh yeah, you pick the cherries that are ripe, so you cherry pick. That means like I not take I not I do not take it the totality. I'm being selective for my own, according to my own taste and for my own personal interest. So cherry pick means also, oh, this section feels sweet to me. This part keeps me in my comfort zone. So let me pick this cherry. That one feels bitter, challenging, unsettling. That's bitter. I won't take that. So Rupa Goswami says, when we find two apparently contradictory statements, we should not cherry pick. We have to contemplate both in a way that they are reconciled. And that's the whole exercise. That's a whole, this you have to train your mind to eventually read Shastra without those lenses, because there's a lot of that. For the untrained mind or eye, they don't see any of that, but they keep incorporating these contradictory notions and then repeating them. Yeah, God is love and you will go to eternal hell. Hey, Krishna Karuna Sindhu, you become a frog. Whatever. They don't even realize how much they are contradicting themselves, how little they are reconciling anything. Then for someone a little bit more aware, they start to see the contradiction, but maybe they are not able to reconcile them and they have a faith crisis, which is a necessary part of the journey, I will say, to leave the previous stage, to leave the previous naivety or the period of blindness. Now you see it, you cannot unsee it, but it's disturbing. But you cannot return to the previous peace and comfort because you have seen it. And then you need to reconcile that, and you may not be able to do it yourself, so you may need someone to help you till eventually we all of us gradually, hopefully, develop our own capacity to see that and read that, how to say, to develop it with such a deep understanding and feeling of what's the essential message around, that whenever something pops up that somehow seems to be somewhere else, very naturally you can see and understand what's actually talking about. Not from a biased thing, a cult, but being so much in tune with the ultimate essence, loving essence of revelation, whatever seems to be otherwise will be naturally put as a secondary detail, as something relative, as something circumstantial, or something that is being misread, not to be taken literally. So many ways that we need to, yeah, to know how to approach the message. Someone raised their hand at one point. Oh,
Comments.
yes, yeah.
It's good, don't
It will add something.
I was just thinking that it's kind of easy for us to balance those two things, the positive and the negative, how Krishna's loving and how he's punishing, because that's usually our experience. The kind of quote unquote love that we've experienced and taught, okay, this is love. It could actually be very, very traumatic. And so we blend those two things together. So in a way, it's kind of easy based on our experience to
Like
merge those
that
two
is telling
things.
me he loves me, but then he's abusing me. And I process the abuse as love on top of that. I'm not even say, okay, he will love me after the abuse. Then you start to feel the abuse as love because he says he loves me, but I don't see any sample.
Example.
Any sample of love apart from this act, so that must be the love.
That becomes your normal.
So that's you normalize abuse as love. Well, yeah, as you said, then you read about an angry God who loves everyone and hates and kills everyone, whatever, demands blood or different. I mean, to be honest, in the Bible, you have very strange, especially in the Old Testament, there are very strange depictions of the divine. Probably the writers were not on a good day when they. The New Testament is redemption to that, to a big degree, but still demanding human sacrifice and this and that and kill all of them and anyhow. So again, that's not God. That's us with our filters, and many times with acquired trauma, internalized abuse merged with in the name of love, and that's it. That's an important point because we are coming again. That's what we were talking, I think, today with Patrick also, that sometimes we may think we have practiced spirituality, and that in itself heals me from all mental imbalance, let's put it that way. But no, you have to be aware that you are arriving to a spiritual life with your baggage, with your luggage of unresolved trauma, misconceptions, fears, filters, assumptions, whatever. And unless you open that luggage and pack and start to deal with that, even as a preliminary foundation for the more deep immersion in spirituality, all those things will become your lenses through which you see so many things, like the example we were talking about. So the and a God that is loving and abusing will make perfect sense because you're, and that doesn't mean that you have developed the capacity to accommodate paradox. Right? Because we speak about that a lot, no? Paradoxical thinking can accommodate apparent opposites. That's not what we are talking about here. No? Because everything can be weaponized, even paradox. Come on, you're not paradoxical enough. Now harmonize my abuse and my love. Make them one. It's like, no. So, yeah, that's important because not all of us come from the same background, but all of us come with some, how to say, background of mixed messages to some degree. Again, there are degrees, but to some degree, some things that were done or given in the name of something that was not the actual thing done or given. So on some subtle level or not so subtle, there is that kind of belief, false belief that, okay, that equates this because it was presented as such. And we may need to see it for what it is and deconstruct that false value. That's, again, as we talk always, an art and everything. You know, an art and everything means deconstruction of false beliefs, false values. Another way, value. I assign value to something as something that is not. No, this is love. I'm putting that value. No, that was not love. That's abuse. That's an art. Arta means value. An art means a false value, a distorted sense of value. A wrong assigning of value. So an art and a rhythm is the systematic deconstruction of all that, which can be difficult, can be painful, can be hard, can be because they are very ingrained and they are second nature, so we are not seeing them. So start to seeing them. It's complicated, but never as complicated as being instrumentalized by those false beliefs themselves. So we want to see what we need to see, as painful as that may be. Well, it's way more painful not to see. This is a paradox. It's more painful not to see. Well, it doesn't, it seems not to feel painful not to see. No, I'm not feeling pain by not seeing. You're telling me that I'm blind, that I'm not seeing it, but I'm fine. So that's the interesting thing. It may not be painful in that way, but it's numbing. Huh? So you are totally asleep. So it may not be painful, but you are completely unaware of the actual reality. So awakening to that is like, ooh. Like I give the example, if I have my left, right arm, I don't know, like this. For some reason, someone told me as a child, you keep your arm like that, a false belief. And I never moved my arm for 45 years. And someone says, like, move your arm. I'm fine. There's no pain, right? It's not painful. It starts to be painful when I move it. But I'm not aware that this arm can have some utility and that I'm totally neglecting the advantage of having an extra arm to use. So, to so it's not painful. But it's, I'm missing the opportunity. So when I try to get advantage of the opportunity, it becomes painful. Right? Till it doesn't become, till it stops being painful. And it becomes just, it's not painful to move my arm. So it's the same, no? Some things we may not see, it's not painful, but I'm completely sleeping to that possibility, to that side of me, being healed, the potential. And when I start to become aware, oof, it's painful. Yeah, it's painful, but keep training the muscle, keep working on that. At one point, it's integrated, no longer painful, and so much coming from that. So, yeah, thank you, Dr. Teresa, for the analogy. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Patrick.
I'm curious about your thoughts about the following question. I hope it's not too quirky or weird.
We'll see.
Sorry.
There may be a hellish planet waiting for you. For those who do quirky questions.
I'm playing around with the thought of the ever expanding, ever evolving, ever new fascination, all those aspects of ever growing love, unconditional love, the spiritual world. And is part of the reason of that growth that every single jiva that makes it into this realm adds to that fascination, that ever newness, because they bring their own take, so to speak, to it into the spiritual world. So there's this ever new fascinations. The people or the siddhas that are there already, they welcome you, they're fascinated by you. You give some sort, you gain this ever newness and freshness from them, this everlasting growth and fascination. Is that why it's ever growing and ever expanding? Or asking the other way around, if no new jivas come there, not that they are bored all of a sudden, but is there something missing for them? Is there kind of, and that's why the desperation, why they are waiting for new people or new jivas to arrive?
Yeah.
Quirky enough?
You have been admitted, just received the message in time.
Of
They have just created a new hellish planet.
the president.
Yeah, out of fascination. Who's that quirky guy? You have a new planet for hosting the uniqueness of your quirkiness. Anyhow. Yeah, in brief, the answer will be no. There, it's not that people in the spiritual world need new recruits or things for things to get funny or interesting or exciting or ever evolving. I mean, they are fine as they are. And let's be clear also, as I say before, actually, what we just read with the arrival of Gopa Kumar, I will put it more as a narrative device that Sanatana Goswami is employing to make the point of how Krishna feels for each one of us. Because the main thing that is mentioned in Shastra is that whomever arrives there doesn't feel like they have arrived. No, they feel that they have always been there. We were talking about that the other day. Here, it's not that they feel like, okay, I just arrived, so where should I go? Okay, that's the reception hall, really, right? So in that sense, we could say there's no actual welcoming, like welcoming retinue, because you are there, you achieve that, and you feel like I've been always there. You're at that moment, you're not thinking, oh, a few minutes ago I was on planet Earth, I was this or that. The subjective experience is this has been my home forever and my identity, which doesn't mean the identity is inherent, doesn't mean that it's predetermined, but it's the subjective experience. I've been here. We may not be able to imagine that because we just can't think in terms of linear time. So I'm not here, and at one point I'm there, and therefore there has to be a welcome party. But in one sense, whomever arrives is immediately feeling, I am here. And as I said before, there are no distinctions about nitya siddhas or sadhana siddhas. So nobody's feeling, oh, that's the newcomer that they arrived the other day. So I'll say these words by Sanatana Goswami that I read before are more like a way of making the point of how Krishna feels for us. I mean, upon our arrival, though, it may not be subjectively felt as an arrival day, and especially how he feels for us before that, during the whole journey. That's the main thing of the statements. It's not so much what happened when we arrived, but how Krishna was feeling for us while we were looking somewhere else. So in that sense, I will say it's not that the people in the spiritual world is like we need more recruits to make the to get the thing more exciting here. I mean, they are not thinking about new recruits. They are completely absorbed in what's taking place there. And again, that can be difficult for us to imagine because we are not there. So how can they not be aware of what's going on here? But they have the same right to say how they, we as, can not be aware of what's going on here. Right? So, of course, at the same time, whomever arrives brings its own flavor and individuality, and it all adds to the ever-evolving overflowing of love. But again, it's not that it's depending on newcomers, so to say, for the thing to get interesting. It's interesting from time without beginning. That basically will be the answer. Again, it's not canceling one thing nor the other. It's not like, okay, they don't need you. They're already having a great time. It's not, I'm not saying that. I said when you arrive there, I mean, as we always like to say, there love creates its own necessities. So there are so many necessities to tend. Now, love has so many necessities to be tended that whomever arrives immediately has service opportunities. Now it's not like, oh, sorry, we're already covered here. No. No, we don't need you. No, love is always expanding and flowing, and therefore there's always engagement and needs to be tended in the context of love. So if nobody arrives, again, I'm talking hypothetically, whomever is there, they are able to tend to the necessities of love in a way that the spiritual world doesn't go bankrupt. Just to give again examples with quantities and numbers, and if you bring 1 trillion souls suddenly, one trillion buses with newcomers, they will all be properly engaged because the necessities of love are ongoing and expansion. So again, we cannot fully figure out in our heads how is that operating, how the Leela sustains itself in exciting with less and more. It's not something to enter with our heads. So, but yeah, that's as much as I could say in that connection. It's exciting, and whoever arrives makes it more exciting, and it gets more exciting. But it not depends on someone arriving for it to get more exciting, something like that. And it's always mutual, right? It's not like, oh, the eternal associates are there and someone new comes. Oh, thank you for bringing this new spice to the masala. And it's all only one way, no? I mean, those who arrive, though they feel I've been here forever, they are feeling they are receiving so much from everyone and everything. So everyone is feeling, subjectively, everyone is feeling, oh, so much is coming. And they feel, okay, let's try to give something in return. Like Srila Siddhamaraj will say, in that realm, everything is your guru. And you are the only disciple. Imagine. Of course, everyone feels the same way. And that's how it works. It's not like a dictatorship. We are all your gurus and you are the only disciple. No, everyone feels genuinely, subjectively, I'm the only servant and everything is to be served here by me. But everyone feels the same way. So the whole economy of the Lila remains sustainable, excitement-wise. And again, let's be honest, it's not just about excitement, right? Because sometimes we project also our notions of excitement and okay, it has to be exciting so I don't get bored. But there are deeper things than just excitement. Because sometimes excitement is more like a peak emotion, and then so sometimes there's no excitement. I mean, like, but there can be deep purpose and deep meaning. Like Viktor Frankl in the Holocaust. I wouldn't say he was experiencing excitement in the concentration camp, but that doesn't mean that he was not having one epiphany after another and revelation and the purpose and meaning and or like I don't know, etihilism and so many others. We'll have in a podcast in a few days about etihilism. I mean, so not to cancel excitement altogether, but just not to make it all about excitement and specifically not about me being excited. Because, and I'm not saying you are thinking like that, but sometimes we may be, like it or not, as we were talking in the morning, we may project the whole dynamics of the spiritual world revolving around us still. Or when we hear about divine love and ecstatic emotion and this symptom, and we may read all of that as type of sense gratification only. I will be experiencing that, and then I will be experiencing that. It's like tasting different flavors of ice cream or something. These like consume ecstasy consumption. No, like I'm going to the supermarket and I'm taking this ecstasy that I'm like eating it. No, I'm the object consuming. Sorry, the subject and the ecstasy is my object, and I'm consuming it. Many times that filter is there until and unless we become situated in the verse we studied today in the morning. Anya vilasita sunyam. Yeah. And that's why so many of our acharyas, even they may feel to some of us, why they are so preventive and why sometimes they are strict in talking about some things, because they know how much we can mess it up, how much we can project, how much we can misread. There's so much to be misread. The highest it gets, the higher it gets, the more and the more probabilities there is for misreading if we are not keeping up the pace of getting higher ourselves. Oh. Not to the point of neurosis, but we need some loving reminder about watch out not to be filtering the final reality through self-centeredness. Watch out not to think that the whole lila is converging in you, that the whole spiritual world dynamics are in your service, and that it's all about what you feel. Not to cancel that altogether, and not to enthrone that at the center, because I mean, we already know how it feels here by trying that. I mean, having all the other people next to us trying the same thing at the same time. We all want to occupy this center throne. There's only one place. We are more than 8 billion. So good luck. And none of those 8 billion are actually the ones who occupy the throne, which is already occupied, by the way. Yeah. Maestro.
Connected to the verse this morning,
Yeah.
my Gurudev used to speak on it quite a lot, or get senior Vaishnavas to speak about it, but they always emphasized within it anugatya. Is that contained within the verse, or is that something that they, it seemed to be quite an emphasis every time that they spoke on it?
How will you like to translate Anugatya for those who are not familiar with the
Convicting
term?
them of like-minded devotees.
Okay, thank you. So yeah, Anugatya means yeah, also kind of like following after, like Anuga, when we say Raga Anuga, Anugatya. Like Anugatya is the act of following in the footsteps of someone. In the context, again, I know that the expression, the phrasing may be a little awkward for Western contemporary mind, following the footsteps of someone. It's not like the literal obsession with some like footsteps, but like, okay, someone is giving a legacy in terms of a life, a teaching, an example, and you try to align your life to that, no? Like guru being our potential appearing in front of us, as we like to say. So anugati implies this type of like, yeah, willingness, healthy willingness, voluntary willingness to submit ourselves to basically to the great steps that lie, how to say, in front of us, ahead of us, to those big walkers of the path. that lie ahead of us. So the term anugatya, if it's included in this verse, yeah. And the immediate thing that I heard, thought what you were mentioning is I will quickly connect with anusilanam. And the two begin with this idea of anu. No? Anugatya, anusilanam. We say anusilanam also the continuous cultivation. So anu can mean ongoing, something ongoing, but also it refers to ongoing cultivation, following after the footsteps of. Here, of course, in this verse, in detail, the notion of sadhu sangha or guru is not mentioned overtly, but we know it's included. What's the opposite of overtly? Implicitly. Yeah, exactly. Not explicitly, but implicitly. In fact, tomorrow morning we'll be studying one verse about Guru. We'll go to the Bhagavatam. So speak about Anugatya and following the footsteps of great path walkers. So yeah, Anugatya implies that. And tomorrow we'll be speak about this verse speaks about surrendering to Guru. So surrender is a form of, okay, I submit myself to this path that has been laid out by these great walkers of life, so to say. But Anushilanam could be that, Anushilanam, not like this. Remember what we say in the morning? Shilanam meant like this engagement with both active engagement and emotive engagement, body, words, mind, thoughts, emotions. Anu can mean continuous ongoing, but also engaging in whatever ways I'm engaging. Following the inspiration of those who have engaged themselves fully and exemplarily, that become a role model to follow. It's again not to promote any, we are not talking here about any personality cult or force submission, but just the natural inspiration to and necessity to have a point of reference. Generally, if someone starts to play the guitar, they have some guitar player that they like. It's not like I don't have any single guitar player in the world, and I will start playing guitar, and I will become my own favorite player. Generally, it doesn't happen. Even if you ask great guitar players, they won't say I am the best, and I have never follow anyone, learn from anyone. Come on. No. You start by copying everyone. Then you develop your own style. So in the beginning also you may follow the footsteps more by imitation than by genuine internalization in your own way. You have to begin somewhere, and then you individuate and are able to internalize those teachings and own them. Quote unquote, own them. They are gift and grace, but internalizing your own, in that sense, own them in your own way. So yes, we could connect Anugati to Anushilana.
Anukulina,
Yeah,
please.
Anu. Yeah. Anukulina. There are many Anus in the verse. Yeah. Yeah, because of course Anugati implies that I give myself in a way that is relishable, that I dedicate myself following the footsteps of someone in ways that are relishable to those people I'm following after. Not that I'm betraying my ancestors, so to say, in the name of following their footsteps, which can happen, or which we can deceive ourselves. Yeah, I'm following my, and you just use it to endorse whatever you want to do, which is not anukulina, which is not intentionally favorable. So, yeah, it demands a lot of, I would say, a lot of self knowledge and self introspection to actually engage in anugatya. It's not just a word. I mean, we can make it a word. Yeah, we follow the footsteps of the previous acharyas. Yeah, but what's the price to pay for that to actually happen? There are so many degrees of anugatya. You know? I mean, this external anugati, the external even proximity to a sadhu, and there can be an inner abyss of distance, and there can be external distance for whatever reason, and there can be absolute proximity. Like Sheila Marsh will give the example of some how would you say in English? Some like
Umbilical cord.
no. Some like microbes or okay. Something that takes away your energy inside your body.
Parasites.
Parasites, yeah. So some parasites, they are very intimately connected with you. No, there's lots of proximity, but they are sucking out your life, so to say. So he will say in the same way, someone can be very close to a guru or a sadhu. Externally, oh, they are following the footstep, but if the proper inner spirit is not there, it can be just a sucking spirit. And that's why it sucks. That's where the word come from. That sucks, which means it's not giving energy, it's sucking, it's taking something away from you. I assume so. I don't know. I'm just it just came now. So yeah, and someone else by contrast can be in a distant situation and be completely aligned in spirit, and that's what counts. And there are so many examples of that. Yeah.
They call them sometimes energy vampires.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have to watch out not to become one of them. Because it's easy to do that. Even without evil intention, because the word vampire can bring some, oh, that's a bad guy. But you can just enter into a pattern of behavior where you just, oh yeah, every time I see the guru, every time I see a sadhu, it's just to bring my stuff and to expect magical answers, and that's it. And when I'm better and at peace, I don't need these guys. I'll call you when I'm in the crisis again. There's no positive willingness to commit, to change, to transform, to do the inner work that actually will get you out of trouble. So it's a way of being an energy vampire, though the sadhus in their generosity may never call you as such. Will not see you probably as such, but or even if they feel something like that, will try to, okay, let's gradually help this vampire to transmute into a butterfly or something. Yes. It's part of the, the becoming givers rather than suckers. I mean, we need to receive, but sucking is another thing, right? Without concern for any form of giving. So, yeah. Someone was raising their hand. Karuneshwari, finally. I mean, you came the other day and you say one question, she had three. So now I'm already bracing myself.
It's nice too. One is from class this morning. I don't know which one to ask first.
You want me to gamble? I don't know
I think
which.
I'd rather ask the other one.
Okay.
Recently, you posted on Facebook a quote from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, when religious identity becomes an idol.
Okay. I assume it's regarding when he speaks about different external ways of ascertaining things and what's the saragrahi essential.
And although on one level it seems like a very straightforward meaning that if you get to it, attached to your own, practices, externals and things in a fundamentalist way, it means you become sectarian, you don't respect other traditions. The message seems simple, but just the way it's phrased, it's kind of fascinating the way he's phrased it, and I felt like it could be unpacked by, I just would love to hear your thoughts on it because it's quite interesting how he phrases it. I have it on my phone, which
I
is
have it here. I just opened, yeah.
the few bits, like in the beginning, when he talks about when someone develops respect, then that seems like a good thing, but he says it leads to hatred of other traditions. And then later on, he talks about like concepts of God being personal or impersonal. I just think there's a lot in it
Yeah.
to unpack.
It's funny because someone asked me that same question, but in the Spanish satsang. Sometimes that happens a few times that someone asks me a question in an English gathering, I say, oh, they're or vice versa. And I find myself never saying the same answer, but responding to the same question. Yeah. Ah, that means it's landing, it's good. So yeah, that's a quote that I shared like 2 or 3 weeks ago, which is from the introduction. Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote many books, and one of them is called Krishna Samhita. That's a very interesting book. Very discombobulating. Like, whoa. Oh, he's saying, oh, okay. Very interesting. The introduction in itself is especially interesting. In this spirit, very broad, very like essence seeker, and very like how to say, very downplaying certain relative elements that many times we don't take as relative ourselves. Clearly, like with unapologetically, it's like that's secondary. That's secondary. That's. And for those who think that's the main thing, after a few that secondary, you're like, what remains? And like he's like doing away with everything. So what will remain? And he's like, trust me, the real thing is waiting for you. But first, we need to get rid of all this stuff. And it's like, this stuff, that was the like this typical example of the interior decorator. No, that you pay someone to come to your house and be an interior decorator, and he comes and starts to take things and throw them out of the room. Like, you're like, what are you doing? I'm paying you not to destroy my and throw away. Say, no, I can only decorate once that we get rid to what gets in the way of the decoration, so we can really access the potential beauty here. Bhaktivinoda Thakur does that very interestingly in the introduction of Krishna Samhita and many other works. Mean, his talk on the Bhagavat that we have shared in the Bhagavat lectures we gave some months ago, that was also, that's very, again, Saragrahi essence like. So anyhow, I can read it, it's short, and then whatever comes, we can share. So I put that title, When Religious Identity Becomes an Idol. That was my title. It's not Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And then I put a quote. He says, as a community, and that's only one part, there's more before and after, but I didn't want to make it too long. As a community gradually develops more respect for its own standards, it develops hatred towards other communities and considers them their standards inferior. Like he's talking in general, of course, he's not saying everyone will be doing that, but the tendency of the masses. These sectarian symptoms are seen in all countries since time immemorial. So it's not just a problem in this group, in this country, in this religion. This is prominent amongst neophytes. So mostly had to do with Kanishtha mentality. Without condemning being a Kanishtha, just it's what it is. And it creates the trouble that it creates. So he says adherence to a particular standard is the prominent symptom of a society. How to do things. This is a bona fide way. This is not bona fide way. That's how you change up. That's how you comb your hair. That's how you dress. That's how you give a class. That's how you sing this song. That's anyhow, endless. There are three types of standards, Bhaktivinoda Thakur brings. Summarizes them in three: Alocha Kagata, Alocha Nagata, and Alocha Gata. Alocha Kagata is when sectarianists accept some external signs. Example of Alocha Kagata are tilak, neck beads, saffron robes, as well as the baptism practice abroad. Again, when he's saying that, he's not saying these things are bad. No, he himself wore robes and neck beads. But he's just saying the problem is when you take this as the final defining, like how to say, measure and stick to prove you are in, you're out, or you are bona fide or not. And then he goes to Alochanagata, different activities, practices in the process of worship, sacrifices, austerities, vows, deity worship, constructing temples, long list, dressing like this, dressing like that, respecting certain books, eating regulations, which again will be different every tradition. And generally, everyone will think, we are the champions, like the song will say. Not them. We won. But the other one will be thinking the same thing. And they will be like, fighting forever. Again, Kanishta level. And then he goes to examples of Alochyagata, which are attributing personalism or impersonalism to God, etc., etc. Speculating on heaven and hell, different speculating is like different ideas people will have of that. Which again, with this, again, this doesn't mean that there's no importance in any of those things. The thing is that when you fully reduce a person to that, no? Like again, as we were talking these days, the other day we were talking about Sayuja Mukti. Okay, someone comes and says, I'm all for Sayuja Mukti. I've in Gyana Mark and I want to merge into Brahman. And I can say, oh, you are inferior. You're an impersonalist. I am personalist. Actually, I'm a radical person. I
Have you
happen
heard?
to have written a book with that title. So I'm very superior. It all begins with a book title. Hell begins with a book title. But actually, you could also say, oh, okay, that's a valid goal in eternity. It's not my cup of tea, but it's yours and it's plausible in eternity. So it's glorious in its own way, as much as I'm not attracted to that at all. So that will be a much more mature way to deal with that than saying, oh, they want something personal. We want something personal, inferior, we are superior. We don't talk to them. Or, and again, in certain level, that statement is there, that caution is there, but not to judge the people, but as a caution for those who in certain stage may be confused. And in some stage, there is place for you to do not listen to anyone, just listen to me. Learn this. Like a baby, like a kid is going to school and getting to know a few friends at school. He's 4 years old, and his friends saying something of what their parents told them, and the other kid is like confused. Oh, their parents saying something different than what my parents. So they come to home like in existential crisis. The world is about to collapse, and the father say, "Just listen to me, okay? Stop listening. That doesn't count." Yet, not yet. Now, eventually, yeah, you will realize there are many parents, many opinions, many everything, diversity. So, anyhow, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is sharing all this. And then he says, concluding, saying, the different forms of these spiritual activities create divisions of sectarianism. Again, in the context of Kanishta, Kanishta Bhaktas. Differences that arise from places, times, languages, behaviors, foods, dresses, and natures. So he's bringing also cultural dimensions here of various communities are incorporated within their spiritual practices and gradually make one community so completely different from another that even the consideration that everyone is a human being may cease to exist. You dress so differently that I would doubt you're human. Or you eat so differently that I doubt you're human. Or you believe so differently that whatever. We shall kill you. And that has happened a lot. It's happening a lot. And many times it's not happening because the law does not allow, but for many people in certain places. But some people, if the law will allow, like I'm for it. No, we just need to do a cleansing and keep the right ones. To reboot the system, start from scratch only with the ones who think like me. Due to these differences, there is disagreement, cessation of social intercourse, fighting, even up to the point of killing one another. So it's a attack. And he concludes saying, when an us-like mentality becomes prominent within the Kanishka Adhikaris, then they certainly indulge in these things. But if they develop a swan-like mentality, then they do not take part in quarrels, rather they endeavor to attain a higher level. So also that's an important point, which is if you are a Kanishka, that doesn't mean that you are like destined to go in that direction. But you may need proper company and guidance to understand, even in your immaturity, like to know how to navigate that, or at least to remain protected in that situation and not fully exposed because you don't have the capacity to deal with all that world of diversity, and gradually become swan-like. Because if not,
better if I close there.
Yeah, I have to. It's fine. I'm fine. Yeah. Thank you. So yeah, that's all about what Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaks about Saragrahi so many times, what it means to be a Saragrahi, what it means to be an essence seeker, what it means to see everyone for who they are, besides any externality. And there are so many layers of externality. We just think there are one or two, but we tend to see and judge each other, even unconsciously, so much and so many things, just the dress we are wearing, this is the most external thing possible, just like the external cloth. I remember when I was answering to this same question, the Spanish satsang, I was in Switzerland, I remember, and I was like this, wearing this cloth, and it was getting hot. No? So I just happened to finish the answer and send them to breakout rooms. Said, this is too hot. So I just stay with my T-shirt. So then they return from the breakout rooms and I was like, T-shirt. So they all look at me, right? And I asked them, so are you looking at me differently? How do you feel? I'm less sacred now. And I could see by the face of some, they actually were confessing that they were. No? So I appreciated their honesty. At the same time, it was a little tragic, but it's part of the process, no? But that, and without criticizing anyone, but that in those cases, I proved, oh my gosh, I'm so external. Because how can possibly an extra piece of orange cotton give me more bhakti adhikar than another piece of orange cotton, which has a different shape. It's like, strictly speaking, it cannot get more external than that.
Yeah.
Right? But sometimes it's like, yeah, but it looks so nice, and it's, or sometimes the, it's a uniform. Give me a break from the uniform. Right? And there are ways we can respond, but at the same time, I mean, we have to, how to say, even if we say all those things, how I'm actually feeling. I'm ascribing more highness or not to a cloth, because that's my issue. You know, whether the person is looking uniform or not, I mean, I'm measuring people by cloth. That's not very gentle. In one sense, it means you don't care for me. You don't know me. You are not contacting me. You are just putting me in a box according to my fashion, my clothing. It's like, well, so, and that, I mean, I don't want to go in that direction much, but that for me still creates a conflict for me regarding which clothes do I wear. Because I'm fine with these clothes I like. They're simple. I don't need to follow any fashion, it's always the same. But also, I don't want to create in others an impression of someone I'm not just because of the cloth I'm wearing. In others, nor in me. So sometimes I will stop wearing these clothes. Okay, but I like that when it's simple. So I'm
Mm-hmm.
resolved. If someday you see me, I mean, you see me during the day. Now I'm dressing for the occasion because sacred moment, Harikat. Every moment is sacred, also, of course. But sometimes you dress specially for some special occasions for me sitting and sharing with you, okay? But I can take out the uniform or walk and for to not scare the neighbors as well. And for practical terms, also, it's too windy outside to walk with this. I'll have to go to all the whole walk, like taking my clothes. Yeah, all that to say, yeah, sometimes we judge one another by the cloth we wear. And that's the opposite of Saragrahi. That's Barabahi, which means load carrier. That's a contrast. Saragrahi is essence grasper, essence taker, essence seeker. Barabahi is load carrier. We carry the load of our filters and prejudices. And I remember one day what told me, no, Maharaj, but I'm very falling and I need you to be wearing those cloths for me to appreciate you. And I understand it, but sometimes that can also become an excuse to remain there, as we were talking the other day. No, I'm very falling, so please adjust to my fallenness. Right, so I don't need to improve. I'm not saying this devotee was saying that, but sometimes that can be the case. So anyhow, these are reflections of Bhaktivinoda Thakur about what's the actual essential thing, and again, it's a daily ongoing introspection process of like peeling the layers, like the onion. So 1, 2, 3, 4. But at the end, there is something inside. At the end of the onion, there is nothing. It's empty. That's why we do not eat onion. That's the real metaphysical reason. After all the layers, there is nothing. We need to be layers, and the real thing is after the layers. So yeah, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is trying. It's very revolutionary because again, for many people, and you can see all over in the contemporary, not only Gaudiya Vaishnava community, any community, like if you in many are still there are this resurgence of movements like Brahmin emphasis. If you are born as a Brahmin, this is the real thing, this higher. And if you are this, or if you're in India, or if you're a man, if you're a woman, sorry, ladies. Or if you dress like that, and if you dress like this, and it's all about Barabahi concerns, externalities. Not to condemn them again, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, yeah, some Kanishas will think like that, what is unavoidable. But of course, hopefully, there's guidance for avoiding what can be avoided in the unavoidable. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, there will be always be some conflict between Kanishas and Madhyams. Because Kanishas like this will think, oh, only if you dress like that and speak like that, you are bona fide. And it's like, and a Madhyam who is more broad-minded and dynamic has been a Kanista. So he or she knows, I understand you, I've been there. But the Kanishas cannot understand the Madhyam. So, you're too liberal, you're diluting the whole thing, watering down, you're a heretic, you're a new agey, whatever. Probably not. He's more loyal to the essence than the fundamentalist. So there will be always some degree of unavoidable friction between that in the society. It's not like which is the button to press, so there's no friction. That only happens from in Vaikuntha. No friction land. So yeah, it's just that's why I shared the post. It's a good piece of advice. And again, some people many times still today, I've been seen a meeting. Maharaj, why don't you have Tilak? It's like, and even if I tell them, yeah, I put Tilak in the morning, and it's you cannot see it, but it's there. No, but I have to see it. Why? What's the difference it makes? And so again, what's the question behind the question? So, yeah, sometimes, and we have heard the story of many Vaishnavas who like. Maybe this is an extreme, but like Pundarik Vidyanidhi, who embraces an outer form that is absolutely bewildering, that looks like an utter sense enjoyer, discarding all these formalities and embracing other form just to disguise himself so people doesn't bother him, basically. Yeah, let them all think like that I may be shy, a sense enjoyer, so I can remain in my internal absorption without disturbance. And they are all thinking that I'm degraded, whatever. It's fine. That's an interesting option. If you are pondering between it, you cannot imitate that. Yeah. Maria, it's good for us to take that as a question again, which ways I'm being attached to formalities, which are the formalities that I'm being attached that I can see and that I know I could work on and gradually relinquish and become more essence seeker, how I'm judging people because they are from a different country, culture, tradition, speak differently, dress different, how I'm in a subtle way compartmentalizing them. Now, why? What's the need behind that? What I'm afraid of? Why am I afraid of being cross-pollinated? Right? Because at
Yeah.
the end, behind all that, there's fear. I mean, there's so much fear. I don't want to be touched by diversity. I don't want to be transformed by you. Why not? Why we are so afraid of change at the end of the day, why we're so afraid of transformation, and that's why we're so addicted to certainty, in other words. No. I am this and I want to remain this and I don't want anything to change or affect me in any possible way, which is not possible. So we become like super rigid and just surrounded by those who think like us, dress like us, speak like us, and then you have like a cult. A dictatorship, whatever. You all dress like this, you all paint your houses like that, you all salute like that, you all speak like that. If someone opposes that, these are the consequences. We know that playbook can start anywhere, at anyone's home, at any moment. Okay. Something else? If not, I think we can put the sharing to rest. Yeah, let's put the sharing to rest, take some fresh air, and we'll see each other tomorrow morning again. Oh, thanks so much for your time. Hope you're having some smooth days in the midst of necessary discomfort and unsettledness. But if it's too much, let us know. Thank you. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Shri Hari Naam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premanand.